been listening to Sound Authors, where authors sound off. If you'd like more information about Sound Authors and Dr. Kent's guests, visit soundauthors.com. Now, back to Dr. Kent and friends.
Welcome back to Sound Authors. Today is the first day of February, and we've all got politics on the mind. My next guest knows quite a bit about that and a whole bunch of other things. He has been a professor in New York and is a very important social critic, and now he's the president of the Hudson Institute. Welcome, Dr. Herb London.
Pleasure to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about what you do every day at the Hudson Institute.
Well, we worry about everything from nuclear proliferation to how do we fight the war against radical Islam. We have 65 senior fellows. The Hudson Institute has a long history as one of the most significant independent think tanks in the United States. Started in 1961, still very much in business, providing support to a variety of governments as well as doing some support through the foundation community.
And you've also got a new book coming out. Can you give me a little information about that?
Well, it's a book about secular humanism and the extent to which the ideas associated with secularism very often stand in the way of fighting the war against radical Islam. They have a fanatical view of the world, of what they believe. We have lost the sense of what we believe. And as a result, what I'm really talking about is the reassertion of American traditions in an effort to serve or create some sort of armor against the attacks, both literal and figurative, that are occurring against the United States.
And in this February period, we just had these two CNN debates on television. What's your opinion of where this country's going right now?
Well, I'm very much concerned. I think the country is very divided. I think that, by and large, we face, as I indicated before, an intractable enemy who has a clear idea of what he's trying to achieve. The United States is not entirely clear. It's obvious from these debates. You have Democratic candidates who continue to argue that we must pull out of Iraq. We have Republicans who are clearly finding fault with one another rather than thinking about what are the issues that would bring America together in some cohesive fashion. And so I'm very much concerned about not only about the nature of the debates, but about the content of those debates, about what is going on, what is in people's minds, and what are our leading contenders really prepared to do.
And now you've had a great deal of attachment to the media. You created a 47-part CBS series. What's the role of the media in this whole? This is the longest election we've ever had. What's your opinion on all of that?
Well, I think the media, one, loves the story, and number two, I think one of the problems is that they love the story so much that the public is now suffering from what I would call political fatigue. I think they're a little tired with all of the discussion about the candidates. We're still a long way from November. I think we've got to truncate this period. I think there's too much talk. I think there's too much emphasis on the political game. There's too much emphasis on who's up and who's down. There's handicapping that's occurring every day. I don't think that it's particularly healthy for the country. And moreover, I also think it has a very negative effect on the White House. The president has been put in the position of looking and acting and sounding like a lame duck. And one of the problems with that is that he's got a lot of time left to conduct his activities as president of the United States. He is commander-in-chief of our military forces, and by and large, he is hamstrung because we are now thinking about what is going to happen on the political front. And by February 5th, next week, we're going to know who the candidates are, and then the contest will really begin. I mean, I thought it began in earnest before, but we have not seen anything yet.
This is a fascinating discussion, and I know you've also run for political office for New York mayor and governor and attorney general?
It's controller.
Controller.
I ran for controller. And again, even in New York, obviously, you're not talking about a national campaign, but it's a pretty large state. And it can be very ugly. Charges are made. I mean, it's remarkable to me. The content, the kind of substance that you're looking for in a candidate and that you think, obviously, should be part of a campaign pales in significance to the trifling matters and the kind of innuendo and the attacks that are made, very personal attacks that are made on candidates. Frankly, I don't think it's healthy for the political system, but unfortunately, that's what we're saddled with.
And tell us a little bit about what it's like to run for office. What's the process? We've got these six candidates left. What's it like going?
Well, the first thing is that it's physically grueling. You really have to be in good shape. When people say, "Well, Senator McCain is a relatively old man," he could not be so old and run for president of the United States because it is grueling. You're on stage all the time. The Klieg lights are always on you. You don't have a moment that you can say is a respite, where you can stand aside and not worry about the political game. You're always on stage. And even if you walk into a room and you think, well, these are just a few friends, you never know what's going to be repeated. So you always, always have to be guarded. It's a very, very difficult task. So the physical and emotional struggle is what I don't think the people understand. Second, one of the things that you want to do is to be up to date on the issues. And so where do you find the time to really understand and study and make yourself acquainted with the issues? Hard work, very hard work. So, you know, the difficulty of running a campaign today is difficult from the standpoint of the candidate. But then there are all of the exogenous characteristics. That is, what role does the media play? How do they think about the campaign? How are they going to convey your message? You may have a certain intention when you try to speak to the American public, but then it's a question of the translation that occurs in the press. How do they think of this? And what they see and what they hear is sometimes more critical than what you actually say, because they're the interpreters, so that the media play a very, very powerful role. McCain had the reputation of being a straight-talking guy. I'm using him only as illustrative. But he had the reputation as a straight-talking guy. But as soon as he says something, like the conversation the other day with Romney, and he says, well, you know, you really did talk about timetables, and Romney denies it. Well, the press is going to say, you know, is McCain suffering from a kind of moral superiority? And then these words, moral superiority, start appearing in the press, and now an impression is created. And so it's very, very important to convey an impression through the press, and it's not easy.
You're also the recipient of a Martin Luther King Award from the Congress of Racial Equality for Citizenship Achievement. And I wanted to ask you, what's your opinion of having an African-American candidate and a woman candidate on the Democratic side?
Well, I think it's terrific. I mean, I think it's terrific for America. It demonstrates a great deal about the progress that has been made for women's rights, for the rights of African-Americans. I don't have any problem with it. But I won't support either of those candidates, and it has nothing at all to do with race or sex. I am principally concerned about candidates who understand the issues. I do not think that Mr. Obama, for example, has the requisite background to run for President of the United States. He's a wonderful guy. He's affable. I think he has a stentorian voice. But I don't think he's sufficiently conversant with the issues to be a president. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, I believe that she's far too shrill, vindictive, and she, too, is somewhat chameleonic when it comes to the issues. So I won't support them, even though I'm thrilled that there are women and blacks in the United States who have the opportunity to run for the highest office in this land.
And now have you endorsed a candidate yet?
I have not endorsed a candidate. My inclination is to probably support the Republican candidate, whether it's Romney or McCain. I know both of these gentlemen. I think they're really fine people. They may not like one another, but I like both of them.
Hmm. And you know, what would do you think the American people would be ready for a Mormon candidate?
Well, I mean, I think that too is problematic. But Mr. Romney made a point during the course of this campaign season when he said that religion should not be a factor. And my feeling about it is that's correct. What Americans want, and they're kind of schizophrenic about the religious issue, they want someone who believes in a religion, but they don't want him to be too much of a believer. They want him to demonstrate that he goes to church or goes to a synagogue or goes to the Mormon tabernacle. But they are not necessarily interested in having him use those religious views in order to dictate policy. And when President Bush said that his hero was Jesus Christ during the course of the 2000 campaign, there were a lot of people who were very upset by that. But the fact of the matter is that we want someone who has a religious belief, as long as it is not too deeply insinuated into the nature of the campaign. My own feeling about Romney is that he, I think, made a very, very good speech when he talked about this issue and said, look, this is not going to be my only guide in what I am. My moral precepts, the kind of gravity in my life, is very much determined by my religion, but my policy perspectives are determined by a variety of factors. And that's the right approach. It was the approach that JFK took in 1960. It is the right approach for a president.
So what do you think about the Republican CNN debates? I was a little bit shocked that they were bantering so much. What's your opinion on how?
I happen to agree with you. I mean, I think that there was too much of that. I'm not so keen, as I said to you before, on these kind of vindictive exchanges. I would much prefer a real discussion about issues. And invariably, what happens is, well, you know, you made this comment back in 6 months ago, and this is what you really meant. No, that's not what I meant. You're intentionally misinterpreting my views. And after all, you didn't even give me time to respond. I mean, that's the kind of exchange. It doesn't produce anything. It creates a lot of heat, but very little light. And my own feeling about it is that you want to create a little illumination in this campaign so that the public watching this will say, look, I really know what these candidates believe. All you know at the moment is there is real anger that exists between these two gentlemen.
And there's you have this new book coming out. You're the head of the Hudson Institute. What is your personal goal for the coming years? What are you working on?
Well, I mean, one of the goals that I have is I recognize the fact that we in the United States face a threat. I said this to you right at the outset, and I'm very much concerned about that. But I think that the way in which you deal with a threat of the kind that we are facing is not only to deal with it externally, but to deal with it internally. Arnold Toynbee, the very famous historian, once made the claim that civilizations are not destroyed by murder, but by suicide. That is, there are internal weaknesses that account for the failure of civilizations. I'm very much concerned about the growth of relativism in the United States, a kind of peculiar multiculturalism in the United States, a lack of patriotism in the United States, a kind of transnational sentiment that does not include the nation. These are trends in America that are deep-seated and are having a powerful effect on the way in which this country behaves. I think it's time, as I indicated to you a moment ago, for us to reassert our own traditions. What is unique about America? What is unique about our Constitution? Why are we a nation that has enjoyed such extraordinary liberty and freedom? What is it about the United States and its people that kind of sets us apart? If I were to ask the question that I asked myself in the year 2000, what's the most important event that occurred in the last millennium? I would say without question, if asked that question, I would say the growth of the United States, the birth of America was the most important development because nothing else could have occurred were not that not the case. If we just relied on the French Revolution, the world would have looked very different. It was the growth of America that accounted for the extraordinary explosion in technology, the efflorescence of the arts, the development of liberty across the globe, the understanding of democracy. It is not a surprise that in the Tiananmen Square that students built a Statue of Liberty. That was the symbol. America has become the symbol, that shining light for the rest of the world. And that's what I think we have to remember. We've lost sight of that, and even in our schools we've lost sight of it. So it's a question of remembering what sets this country apart, why are we truly unique.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion with Dr. Herb London. We can visit his website online at www.herblondon.org. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, my pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much, and again, I apologize for being a little late.
That's okay. And my next guest is Kevin Bear. We'll continue the discussion about politics and much more. Come on back.